You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freib.
Hello. How's it going?
Very good, Daniel. How are you?
Good, good, good. Where are we? Where are you?
Where are we? Where are we, Lionel?
We're in deepest Hertfordshire today.
Deepest, darkest Hertfordshire. And Daniel, you're still out there in Berlin. We're convening later this week in London. Looking forward to that, chaps. That'll be next week's podcast. Will be coming at you from London. But you're fresh from the Berlin 6 Day, Daniel. We'll be hearing about that a little later in the podcast.
Definitely one of the best 6 days I've ever been to. Definitely in the top.
Would you mind if I read out the text messages that you sent me last night when you were on your way to the track?
I have a feeling whatever I say, you're going to do it anyway. So,
excellent. Before we get onto any of that, there is obviously a lot to talk about as ever. Lionel, can you give us the weekly news roundup, please?
I certainly
fake
can.
News roundup.
Enough
any
of
fake
that.
News this week?
Oh, we haven't done any.
Any
fake
alternative
news.
Facts?
No, we haven't done any fake news this week.
Well,
we?
Okay.
Oh, it's all real news.
As you were.
It's all real news this week. And can I say it's really excellent news this week? As I predicted, you know, I don't like predictions, but I did predict that Richie Porte would win the Tour Down Under, and he did so. He won on Willunga Hill for the fourth year in a row.
Are you going to do the news roundup in the style of Donald Trump every week from now on?
No, that I just did one half sentence in the style of Donald Trump.
And your prediction coming
He's gonna
true.
He's going to do this on Sean Spicer.
Anyway, go on.
So yeah, Richie Porte won the Tour Down Under, fourth year in a row that an Australian has won the race. Caleb Ewan won all the sprint stages, and in common with last year's race, every single stage was won by an Australian rider, so a real festival for the Aussies. The Vuelta a San Juan has just got underway. Fernando Gaviria of Quickstep won the opening stage, slightly chaotic finish to the race, where one half of the bunch went one side of a long traffic island, the other half went the other way. Apparently there was a mix-up with the map in the road book, so some riders had the correct information, others didn't. But Gaviria, probably the fastest sprinter in the race, so the correct result there. That race is ongoing until the weekend in Argentina. Some sad news that former under-23 world champion Dimitro Gabrovski died from a suspected heart attack the other day, aged just 31. The Ukrainian won the rainbow jersey in Madrid in 2005, turned pro for Quickstep in 2007, had some well-documented problems with alcohol, later joined the ISD team. I think Daniel wrote a very good feature about him a few years ago, and we'll no doubt ask Daniel for his memories of Gabrovski shortly. This weekend, it's the World Cyclocross Championships. The World Cup came to an end, weekend just gone. The big news is that the reigning women's World Cyclocross champion, Thalita de Jong, is a big doubt when it comes to retaining her rainbow jersey in Luxembourg at the weekend, because she crashed in the final round of the World Cup in Hoogeheide and has injured her thigh and knee. The latest is that she will travel with the Dutch team, and she's been named in the team, but at the moment it's looking unlikely that she will start the race. However, better news for the Dutch, Marianne Vos is in great form. She won the final round of the World Cup solo ahead of two other Dutch riders, Lucinda Brand and Anne-Marie Vorst. And Sophie de Boer, another Dutch rider, won the World Cup title overall, even though she could only finish eighth in the race. In the men's World Cup, Lars van der Haar won the race. Van Aert of Belgium won the World Cup title. The Cyclocross Worlds are on at the weekend in Luxembourg. Women's race on Saturday afternoon, the men on Sunday. And while we're looking ahead to the weekend, the CBS network in the United States is scheduled to broadcast its investigation into motorised cheating in cycling. Is that on Saturday, I think,
Saturday.
Richard? Yeah, so no doubt that will be eagerly awaited. And also this week, Nicole Cook, former World and Olympic road race champion, was giving evidence to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee's investigation into doping, and we will cover that later on in the episode.
We'll cover that later in the episode. I should also say that this week we're releasing two podcasts because it's the time for the Cycling Podcast Femina, our monthly look at women's cycling. I'll be joining Orla Shinawee for that. That's probably out already, actually. I think that's coming out 24 hours before this podcast. But it's available on the usual channels, Cycling Podcast Femina. We will be talking a bit about some of the allegations made by Nicole Cook. Because really, although that investigation at the DCMS is primarily into doping, in sport, she really turned the spotlight onto sexism, I guess, institutional sexism. We'll talk about that in the Cycling Podcast Femina, as well as in this episode. We won't be talking much about cyclocross, but we will be talking about that too in the Cycling Podcast Femina. We have a big cyclocross theme. We've got an interview with Katie Compton, the American rider, in that episode, but we're not on very solid ground, so to speak, appropriately enough, when it comes to cyclocross, despite one of us, Lionel, being a chairman or president of the of the British branch of the Sven Nys fan club.
Yeah, I think that may well have lapsed with Sven Nys's retirement, though, to be fair. Can you be a fan of a retired rider? I guess so.
Probably in Belgium.
Did you guys catch up on that piece of news the other day that Gianni Moscon, the Sky rider, well, his fan club dinner, these fan club dinners are quite a big thing in Italy, usually held in a village hall or a sports hall or something, always in the winter, and they get 200, 300 local people to come along. Gianni Moscon was serving up some kind of pasta dish with salmon, the salmon having been sourced from the Arctic race of Norway, and it was his prize for winning the overall classification there. And I think it was 500 kilograms of salmon that were being shipped over from Norway for his fan club dinner. So anyway,
that
sorry.
Must be quite a big fan club. No, if they're going to polish all that off. He's a talented musician as well, is he not? Gianni Moscon, is it the piano he plays?
Possibly. Likes tractors, doesn't he? He's passionate about tractors. Anyway, napalm.
This is now the Gianni Moscon cycling podcast. Yeah, I was inducted officially as the UK president of the Sven Nys fan club. I joined his fan club to watch the cyclocross race at Coxeter in Belgium several years ago now, probably 10 years ago now. And it was a bit like a sort of football away day for them. They set off from his hometown in a coach. The coach was full. The luggage compartment underneath the coach was absolutely rammed full of crates of beer. And it was basically a drinking expedition from one side of Belgium to the next. And some of the fans, when we got off the coach, I mean, I was taking it easy because I wanted to watch the cyclocross, but some of them were finding it tricky to walk over the sand dunes of Coxeter. But yeah, I had they made me up a little membership card and everything, and I was the honorary UK president. I'm very happy to be so.
Excellent. Well, that's good. And do we have anything else to say about the cyclocross? Not really. It's been covered in the news round up there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's whether or not Matthew van der Poel can win, I suppose, in the men's race. His father, Adrie, was a world champion in cyclocross and also a very good road rider, won stages of the Tour de France, won the Tour of Flanders. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if he can win. And Marianne Vos, well, she won the first of her 7 world titles in 2006, and she's going for number 8 and looks in great form. So yeah, always interesting to watch the cyclocross world championships, but there's not a tremendous depth to the field, is there? Probably better than it used to be, but still it is the preserve of the Dutch and the Belgians, and then kind of a sprinkling of riders from other countries.
We're going to be joined on the Cycling Podcast Femina by Ian Cleverley, the ruler editor, who's a big cyclocross aficionado, so he'll be giving us the chapter and verse on cyclocross. But the Tour Down Under is what we were going to talk about at the start of this episode. Lionel, you mentioned Richie Porte obviously won the race, first time he's won it overall. He's looking obviously extremely good, but all the stages of the Tour Down Under won by just 2 riders. You were a bit dismissive of the Tour Down Under, as is now traditional, last week. Somebody suggested on Twitter they were going to start a crowdfunding campaign to get you over to the Tour Down Under next year. I'm fully behind that. Fully.
I'd like to protest this in the strongest possible terms. I think my objections to going to Adelaide in January are that it will just be too warm and sunny. The wine will be too cold. I mean, I can't possibly be expected to eat 6 or 7 barbecued meals, you know, in the space of a week. I'm really not up for this whatsoever. So I really hope nobody donates generously to the crowdfunding.
No, it's pot. You're very sincere in that. When a race is dominated by 2 riders in the way that it was, it's a bit disappointing. I think, you know, the point you made last week about the race was that it's kind of neither one thing nor the other. It's neither a pre-season friendly nor a really, really meaningful race. But what it is, as we saw on TV, is a fantastic spectacle for the fans out there. And when you look at some of the races that are disappearing in Europe and the lack of support for some races, what they have there is great infrastructure, great roads, great weather, great fans, you know. And perhaps, I was thinking about the point you made, perhaps there's an argument to move it a bit further into the season and give it more prominence rather than, you know, keeping it in its current slot.
I think Daniel really made the point that it's too good for this slot, and I kind of was thinking about that and expanding on that point. I think that with the World Tour, and we talked about this last week, the World Tour calendar looking such a mess and so, you know, it doesn't join up very well now. I think there's a real chance to, in the process of reevaluating what is important and what are the successful races and what are the less successful races, there's an opportunity to bring some cohesion to the World Tour calendar. Maybe in years to come, there could be more events in not just Australia, but, you know, maybe New Zealand, other parts of Asia, and have a sort of Australasian swing, which kind of starts off the season before everything then moves back to Europe, perhaps via the Middle East. I mean, I don't want to just sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater, but, you know, when you look at the Tour Down Under as a commercial vehicle, as a sporting spectacle, you know, it's got so much more life and vibrancy than perhaps even the likes of Paris-Nice or the Tour of Catalonia or Tirreno-Adriatico. But those races have, you know, function within the race calendar. They're either as races that have a good deal of history, you know, 60, 70 years in the case of, you know, or longer in the case of Paris-Nice. But certainly I wasn't seeking to denigrate the Tour Down Under and say that it, you know, that it shouldn't exist, or that I just think it's outgrown its current slot in the calendar, and it would benefit from being seen as a real objective in its own right. And rather than just having Richie Port and Caleb Ewan home-based, you know, Australian riders for whom it's a really serious objective, it would be great if it was a truly international event.
Yeah, although I don't think there's anything wrong with having an event which is the cup final for one particular nationality, and that's what the Tour Down Under obviously is. And, you know, I remember the Tour of California when I went in 2006, and it was a big battle between Floyd Landis and Levi Leipheimer, and it really didn't seem as though anyone else was too bothered, but it still made a great spectacle because it meant an awful lot to those two riders. They were based in California. The same with the Tour Down Under. I thought, you know, Richie Port wrote a letter, didn't he, after he won the general classification, thanking the fans. It obviously meant a huge amount to him. There was a fantastic interview with Nathan Haas as well, who I think finished fourth on general classification, third. After the Willunga Hill stage, where he sort of talked about what a huge objective it was for him, I think, to our colleagues at SBS, and, you know, how much it all meant to him. So, you know, there is a sense of occasion there, and, you know, the same with the sprinting. I mean, what we probably shouldn't do is read too much into Caleb Ewan dominating the sprints in the way that he did. You know, he does look very impressive, and he's certainly got a very unique style of sprinting, but he's still very, very young, and he's still very inexperienced, as the Giro showed last year. He went there with high hopes, and it's really struggled in the sprints.
Apologies, Nathan Haas was actually fourth in the end. He was equal in time with Jay McCarthy, but yeah, McCarthy got the edge on the final stage. And Esteban Chavez, of course, up there in second. I mean, yeah, Willunga Hill was the decisive stage, it always is. And Richie Port was completely untouchable there. Nathan Haas was dropped pretty early, but came back. It was quite surprising to see. You know, Chavez is obviously not at his best, is he? But Richie Port looks pretty phenomenal.
Is it just me that always wants to suffix Willunga Hill with mate? It's Willunga Hill, mate. Or look, Willunga Hill.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast, along with our headline sponsor, Rafa. A reminder that you can get 20% off Science and Sport products. All our listeners are entitled to 20% off if you enter the code TCP20 at the checkout. If you go to scienceandsport.com, TCP20 will get you 20% off. I mentioned also last week that we're going to be giving away some tickets and things this year, thanks to Science and Sport. They're offering couple of tickets for the London Bike Show, which is coming up in mid-February, and we will we'll give you details next week about how you can win two tickets. In the meantime, keep the middle of February clear.
Well, you mentioned science in sport. A slightly amusing thing happened to our friend and colleague Simon Gill, our photographer. He covers the Tour de France and other races, usually in his VW camper van, drives around the races in that. And just before Christmas, he was emptying out his loft and put a load of stuff in the camper van before taking it to the tip. Didn't get round to taking it to the tip. And then, you know, a good few weeks after he'd put all this junk in the back of his camper van, he sort of had a sense that something might be living in his camper van, and he opened a box which was of a load of SIS products, gels and bars and powders that turn into drinks, and there were mouse droppings in there. And obviously a mouse had been in all of his junk and had made itself at home in his camper van and had been feasting on science in sport products. So the hunt was on for the mouse that he then nicknamed Sir Chris Hoy Mouse. And Sir Chris Hoy Mouse was eventually found.
Hang on, living. I don't think he'll catch it if it's been consuming all these science and sport products. He's not going to catch it, is he?
This is absolutely true. This is not sponsor-related product, content here. Anyway, Sir Chris Hoy Mouse was eventually found living under one of the hippos in an old game of Hungry Hippos
with a VO2 max of 110. Yeah, amazing, amazing,
incredible, anyway. Incredible stuff. Well, as I say, we will be giving away tickets for the London Bike Show in mid-February. Stay tuned for details about how to win those tickets. Now, we were going to talk about something quite sad in this part, the death at the weekend of Dmytro Grabowski, a prodigious talent who was quite troubled. Daniel, you got to know him a little bit and interviewed him a couple of times, I think. One of them, I think, at the 2010 Tirreno Adriatico. I remember, and you wrote about this in your piece, but stage one, he was sort of on the comeback trail and he put in this big solo attack. He got 10 minutes at one point, and it was very, very cold. I remember he was eventually reeled in, and I'm trying to remember who won that stage. Linus Gerdeman won that stage, I recall. Another one who's disappeared, perhaps.
He's running a fusion restaurant in Dea in Mallorca, which I went to last year.
Ah, yes, second home in Mallorca. Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll talk about Gerdeman another time. But Grabowski, very sad. He was 31 years old, living in Israel now, I believe, and died of a heart attack. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, at first glance, this looked like way back in 2004, 2005, when he was so successful as an under 23, it looked like a typical story of like an old former Soviet nation rider, an old Eastern Bloc rider, of which there were a lot in those years who were coming over and dominating under 23 worlds and races like that. And Grabowski, sure enough, won the worlds in Madrid, the road race. He also finished second in the time trial, and he signed for Quickstep. And and I met him at the Quickstep training camp the following winter, and it proved not to be a typical story, quite an unusual story for several reasons. He'd had quite a difficult upbringing. His dad had been a successful bike rider, but had not wanted him to become a cyclist at all, discouraged him from becoming a cyclist. And then Grabowski's mother was a physiotherapist, and one day she came home from work and announced that she was leaving, that she had a job in Israel. She'd found a job in Israel. So off she went, and Dmytro was 16, I think, at the time. And then shortly afterwards, his dad left as well. And it seemed quite a curious story, quite an odd story. But Dmytro explained that he'd just been left on his own at 16 in his house, and occasionally his uncle would drop in on him. But at the same time, he was having quite a bit of success. He'd taken up cycling against his father's wishes by that point. And he was winning big under 23 races in Ukraine under a false name, because he wasn't old enough to compete in under 23 races. I think he'd come up with the name, or someone had come up with the name Tatarenko, Dmytro Tatarenko. And he was winning these races, and then he won the worlds. And he was a real kind of roguish sort of character, had a wonderful sort of impish smile. And there was definitely a bit of a Jack the Lad about him. I remember asking him on that first time I met him whether he had a girlfriend, and he told me he had four in Italy and lots back in Ukraine. But he didn't really have a whole lot of success with Quickstep in that first year, and then he sort of rattled around there for a couple of years, and then his first mentor in Italy, Luca Shinto, who was running what became the ISD team, well, he'd managed Grabowski as an amateur and then took him onto his pro team. And that was when we became aware that Grabowski had been suffering from these problems of alcohol, alcoholism. And that really hamstrung the rest of his pro career. I mean, there were all sorts of incidents. There was one particular occasion when he was drunk behind the wheel and five times over the limit, and he crashed his car in Tuscany. And the emergency services arrived and assumed that he must be dead, looking at the state of the car. And then a few moments later, he crawled out, almost unhurt. And that was fairly typical, I think, of his lifestyle in a certain period around 2010, 2011, 2012. And he kind of disappeared off the radar 2012. I'd spoken to him a few times over the years, but then hadn't heard from him since 2012. But apparently, you know, he was doing okay. He had two kids. The second child was only born a few weeks or months ago. And he'd stopped drinking, supposedly. That's what he told his friends. And he was training to do Ironmans. And and then he died of a heart attack earlier this week.
And he was living in Israel.
He'd gone back to Israel. So he'd actually finally joined up or followed his parents in Israel. And he'd even ridden the Israeli national championships a couple of times. I think won it one year in 2013-14, something like that. A sad story, really, and very sad looking back and reading some of the things I wrote in 2010, 2011. You know, Luca Shinto, as I said, his team manager at one time, his mentor, saying very explicitly then that if he wasn't careful, Grabowski was going to end up like Pantani, end up like Van den Broek. It was that his cycling, really, although he was still riding as a professional, wasn't important. What was important was saving him as a person.
Parallels with Van den Broek, perhaps, and Pantani, I guess, in that, you know, he had retired and or stopped competing as a professional, at least, and seemed to be getting his life back on track, as Van den Broek sort of did as well in the months before he died.
Yeah, the problem in these cases, and there have been several of them in cycling, is that, you know, there is this idea or hope on the part of, you know, these riders' friends or their entourage that cycling can help them in some way. Cycling can be some kind of therapy, that cycling is where they feel good or it can get them healthy again. But I think often, you know, the riders who are troubled like this, they find themselves confronted with, you know, a lot of expectations when they go back into cycling. They've also got this precedent of when they were very successful in the past and a better version of themselves in their youth, and they can't live up to that anymore because, you know, it's more competitive now, or because they have damaged their bodies and stuff. And then maybe it becomes, you know, the issues become exacerbated. I don't know if that's what happened with Grabowski, but, you know, I mean, we all know what a pressurized environment professional cycling is, and there's no real comfort blanket. There's no, you know, no team is going to take you on and say, look, you know, if it takes you 4 years to get better, we're going to be with you every step of the way, and we're going to be with you when you are better.
Yeah, and you know, given that pressure that there is, you know, just to perform your duties as a professional cyclist in a competent way, When there is release from that, it can lead to excess, can't it? I mean, a rider that you know a lot about, Jan Ullrich, you know, when he was sort of let off the leash, as it were, he did live his life to excess in all sorts of areas. And, you know, that it's not necessarily conducive to a sort of healthy, balanced life, is it?
No, I mean, the one, I suppose, good thing about cycling in that respect is that you can't hide alcohol abuse or, you know, even overeating. You will be found out very quickly, whereas I suppose there are sports in which it can almost go undetected for years and years. But in professional cycling, you simply won't survive if you're abusing your body over a long period of time. But yeah, it's a very sad story, and one that does have strong echoes in the recent history of professional cycling, with the likes of, you know, as we said, Jose Maria Jimenez, Van den Broek and Pantani. I mean, there have been several of them now, haven't there?
And another very bit of sad news at the weekend in completely different circumstances, but a young British cyclocross rider, Charlie Craig, only 15 years old, passed away, also believed to be a heart failure in his sleep. He was the son of Nick Craig, who was for many years and still is, in fact, a leading cyclocross rider, very good cyclocross rider and mountain biker at times as well, and a lovely guy, Nick Craig. So incredibly sad news. His son, Charlie Craig, was a, a promising young cyclocross rider, part of the British setup, and died age 15. Very sad indeed.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor here at the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful indeed to them for their continued support. Now, I think we're turning our attention to track cycling in this part of the podcast. Daniel's kind of hiding away there, but I said I'd read out a selection of your text messages, Daniel, because I gave you this assignment last week. Obviously, you're in Berlin, a 6 day in Berlin. It seemed a logical thing to get you to go and, you know, bring us a flavour of the pod of the 6 day racing.
That wasn't the assignment. That wasn't the assignment. Assignment was
that
very
wasn't
specific.
The assignment.
Anyway, go on.
It was very specific, and I think you failed.
I did fail, but
anyway, never mind. Send me. I'll read a selection. Still trying to avoid the track / hoping you'll forget. Just in case I can't actually go to the six aside. At one point, is what you called it. A few of these messages I probably can't read out. You make some very interesting points about track cycling. There's no proper calendar, no narrative, no stars. I prefer ski jumping. At one point. Let me see. Sorry, I just got to scroll down a bit. How do you interview people at the track? Is it between races in the middle of the Velo Bowl? I asked you to interview Katie Archibald. You replied, what sport did she win Olympic gold in?
Oh, this is a right stitch up now. Very much tongue in cheek. Before we lose all of our sponsors.
Oh, hang on. They're playing an Earth, Wind and Fire Michael Jackson mashup, so I'm happy enough at the moment, he said, once he was actually in the Velo Bowl. Excellent.
True
Very
story.
Good. So Daniel,
true story.
Having made it there, what did you make of it?
No, it's good. Look, I've been to 6 days. I've been to 6 days before, and I want to like them. I really want to like them because I think they're a great event. And it's a great concept. What lets it down is the cycling part. I honestly, like, all joking aside, now I find it a very impenetrable format. And I think from the point of view of a lay spectator, a lay fan, someone, you know, like myself, who has an interest in other forms of cycling, but is not particularly au fait with how 6 day works and how the 6 day scene works and who the 6 day riders are, I find it very, very viewer spectator unfriendly.
I find myself in a very awkward position between you and Lionel. You know, I'm sort of firefighting here. I'm thinking, on the one hand, Lionel alienating our Australian audience with his anti-Tour Down Under comments, and then you, Daniel. I mean, 6 day racing is one of the great fixtures of the cycling season. Mm. What's not to love about a Madison?
Well, do you know what, Rich? I was thinking about this the other day, and I think, you know, one of the things that I love about cycling is that the various different ways and the various different reasons for which people approach the sport and the things that pull people in. And for some people, you know, they're interested in bikes almost because they're interested in motorbikes, or for some people they're interested in bikes because, or interested in cycling because they're interested in physiology, and, you know, it's not so different from swimming or running or whatever. And to be honest, one of the main things that attracted me to cycling in the first place was nature's kind of canvas. And the fact that, you know, you are, well, in road cycling, you are out in the outdoors, and, you know, you have this latitude to explore, and there is this sense of adventure. You can go whichever direction, you know, wherever the mood takes you. And none of that really figures in track.
It doesn't.
Racing.
It doesn't. And I agree with you. And I think all three of us are probably, our main interest is obviously in road cycling. But you don't find that once you burrow deeper into the sport, that leads to at least a passing interest in bikes, and an interest in the athletes, the riders, as people, as athletes. And obviously 6 day racing, you get to see some incredible athleticism. It's an incredible physical test. And test of skill as well.
Well, and in terms of developing riders for road careers, I would be a massive advocate of track cycling, because you see it, and you've seen it in a generation of British riders, how skilled they are on bikes and how they have very specific skills. Specific, you know, they're fast, and therefore, you know, they're race winners. And the British system, whatever else has been, we're going to discuss about other issues to do with the British cycling, the British system. I think the track cycling, the success they've had, is a massive advert for the benefits of track cycling, the development of good cyclists. So I think that's undeniable.
I'd also say, you know, just to step in on my criticism of the Tour Down Under.
I mean, We've covered that.
I don't want to be.
Going back. I'm just to playing, Tour Down Under.
Playing a very long game. Just trying to get myself a trip out there. But I do think, you know, we talked a little bit about cyclocross and why we don't cover it in depth in the podcast. I mean, both track and cyclocross are more accessible than probably they've ever been. There's more of it available to watch either online or on TV. There's been a lot of track racing on Eurosport. The bike channel's now been showing a lot of cyclocross over the winter. But these do remain kind of niche areas of the sport, and they're there to be enjoyed in their own right, as, you know, as they are. They're a nice diversion over the winter. And I do think that the fact that the road season, you know, basically kicks off again pretty much straight after Christmas with the build up to the Tour Down Under, you know, it encroaches on the room that track and cyclocross have to spread out into. And I certainly think that the attempts to try and make a sort of a coherent overarching, I don't want to say the word narrative, that's banned, isn't it, but to try and make a 6-day season that leads somewhere, you know, it hasn't really been a success. I said back in London at the London 6-day, I was looking forward to seeing how these events would go and how the Revolution Champions League would go. That didn't really catch fire, did it? The Paris round had to be cancelled. And talking to the guys at the Ghent 6, you know, they're not in this structure with London, Berlin, Amsterdam, Copenhagen. They're existing outside of it, mainly because they've got an event that works and is popular and exists because, you know, it's not even really on television, is it? It's not on television in Belgium. And I think they show the Sunday afternoon and that's pretty much it. It exists as an event for people to go to. That is thriving. The first year ever that the Ghent 6 has sold out all days in advance. I mean, so there is life in it. It's just that, as you say, Daniel, it's not attracting road stars. The heyday, probably in that sense, the 60s, 70s and even the 80s, when, you know, you'd even see Laurent Fignon or Stephen Roach taking part in 6 days. You know, you can't really imagine the equivalent riders today lining up on the track. It's really going to be the kind of road sprinters, Viviani, Cavendish, that kind of rider that will be attracted. And they're always going to be the big draws, aren't they? And if an event doesn't have those sorts of riders, is it going to capture the imagination in the same way? Possibly not.
Well, Daniel, I mean, Berlin, what was... We didn't see Berlin on TV, and I think you can tell us why. And what was the crowd like? Tell us about the crowd.
Maybe first we should hear from the organiser of the Berlin 6, who I spoke to last night. He's a gentleman called Valts Milkovits or Miltovits. He comes from quite an unusual background for someone in his position. His last job was with the FIBA, which I think is the European Basketball Association, or is it it's the World Basketball Association. And he took on this job a few months ago. Lionel, you mentioned the fact that Berlin is now one of a series of 6-day events that have tried to group several 6-day events, high-profile 6-day events, together under one umbrella. It's the Madison Sports Group is the group behind that. And so I spoke to Valts Miltovits about the series, about Berlin, and about how satisfied he was thus far.
The goal is relatively simple. We have fantastic examples around the world where things like that work, like ATV, Formula One. Or if you look at the winter sports here in Germany, where you see luge, where they have series, or skiing, or ski jumping. In cycling, in 6 days, especially in 6 days, they have been singular events. Every one is singular event. They have nothing in common, really. They sort of know each other, the organizers, but they don't really work together. So building a series out of it, building sort of a traveling tour, is what I feel is a really good perspective, a really good goal to achieve for a sport like this. So the goal is to not make like one or two events to survive. That's definitely not a goal. The whole goal here is to build a very good proposition, which is similar to mentioned ATP or Formula One, but on the track, and it has all the assets that's necessary. A good example is my brother. He's today here for the first time in his life, just like me. And he's like completely taken away with the event and with the racing, and he's just sitting there and following, and even though he doesn't understand. I think that's the beauty again, even if you don't understand, that nation, that overall feeling, the overall sort of that ambience, that passion that's happening, those bursts of explosions and emotions going on, they just captivate you. Even if you don't understand, you start becoming interesting. What's happening there? And sure enough, at the second medicine, you already know. So it is, I agree, it is complicated, but it can be explained and can be done. 6 days originally were created for the road cyclists to practice in the winter. Now you can ride all year long. You have races right now going in, you know, going down under, for example, or South America or Middle East, starting in a few weeks. So that takes away all those big names. No questions asked. And we struggle with that. All the 6 days struggle with that. I think we just need to admit it, that's what it is, that how the world has changed, and try to do something else. Concentrate our attention not on getting those names, but maybe by providing this series concept, this possibility for those riders to have a planned winter season, and giving the opportunity to give an exposure to the riders who are stronger on the track rather than on the road, we eventually, in the longer term, we are able to build track cycling names rather than try to bring and take away road cycling.
You know, there's been a lot of excitement about 6 days series being on Eurosport, and I think it's decent figures, I think. And then, unfortunately, you've not been able to show it on Eurosport this week. So could you just explain why?
Well, it was a very difficult decision, and that goes actually in line with what you said in the very beginning. Berlin, not Berlin particularly, but 6 days is a very hard sell, and it is hard sell today. And then we need to make a decision whether we invest a load of money in production for TV, or we rather invest that, you know, maybe not all of it, but a big portion of it in the event experience and in the riders. We eventually decided for the latter. It was very short before. It was a very difficult decision. There were other issues as well, which, well, maybe not that important. It's just complicated to explain. It's much more going on there. But bottom line is, make it simple. It is a financial decision as well. I mean, we are trying to make it work, and with all the investors behind. Behind us, it doesn't mean that we can just, you know, throw money in the wind. I'm very happy that for a couple of hours I got the report of the tickets, the final report of the, like, final up-to-date report on ticket sales. And it's fair to say now, it's clear that this year we have increased the ticket sales by 20% compared to the previous 2 years. So which is a fantastic improvement. And people could see that, especially on Saturday when we were forced to close the doors, basically. I think generally, we're on a good way to get younger audience, but it's never going to happen. We never thought it's going to happen in 1 year or two or even three. 5-6 years, maybe. Then we will get the average audience will be younger. But therefore, we need to respect our fan base as well. And it doesn't matter what age they are.
So, chaps, that was Valt Miltovits, very genial fellow, very affable fellow.
and very open-minded as well, very understanding, as you could hear there, of my perspective and the fact that, you know, I think the Berlin 6 Day is quite a hard sell. And the thing that strikes me about 6 Days and struck me particularly about the Berlin 6 was that the majority of the crowd are quite old, and you get the sense that it is a bit of an institution in Berlin life. I mean, the Berlin 6 Day, there have been more events of the more editions of the Berlin 6 Day than any other 6 Day in the world. And it is part of, well, it's an institution really in Berlin, and you get the sense that people have been going there, the majority of the people there have been going for 10, 15, 20 years, but I don't suppose... It didn't look as though there were too many people there for the first time, young people, people under the age of 40. And I think, you know, the difficulty with 6 Days is there are obviously elements of, you know, there's music, there's a lot that goes on besides the actual racing. But what do you pander to? What do you appeal to? What do you focus on? Do you focus on bringing people in through those, the sort of sideshow, or do you actually try to get people more and more interested in the racing? Do you try to create connoisseurs of 6 Day racing? I think it's difficult.
I think in Berlin, I mean, what they did in London, where there once was a 6 Day tradition and there hasn't been, you know, the way that they got the audience along was to have the superstars, Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins. In Germany, in Berlin, you know, who's to say you couldn't have John Degenkolb, or, you know, I don't think Tony Martin has got a particular pedigree on the track, does he? Unfortunately, you know, nothing to say that he wouldn't be a very good rider on the track, of course. There hasn't perhaps been that those German superstars don't have the background in track riding that the British riders do have, as you mentioned earlier, Daniel, you know, Marcel Kittel. But if you could get those guys along to ride the 6 Day, that might attract in that you know, a cycling audience. And not, I don't think those guys have the same status in Germany as Cavendish and Wiggins have in the UK, perhaps. But that would be one way to just raise the profile, because it did strike me looking at the start list that, you know, you've got some of the stars, certainly of 6 Day racing, you know, Kenny DeKettle, Moreno De Pau, these guys, but not the sort of crossover stars.
Professional cycling does not get a huge amount of coverage in Germany. I think it's well documented. We've spoken about it on numerous occasions in the past, that since sort of doping cataclysm that happened in 2006 with Operation Puerto, Jan Ulrich being exposed, cycling in Germany, professional cycling, has really suffered. And so I don't even, you know, John Degenkolb is not a huge name in Germany. It's not a name that will be familiar to a huge number of people. And, you know, Berlin's a city with an incredible cycling culture, but it's not a cycling culture which really rubs up against professional cycling in any way. And I think, you know, I spoke to the organizer of the Berlin 6 Days there, and I think the challenge is finding a middle ground between some of the things that he wants to do, engaging young people, engaging some of the kind of artist culture and the street cycling and the kind of courier and the fixie culture and scene in Berlin, and finding the sort of the point of the Venn diagram where that meets with the people who have been going for years and years. But how do you appeal to both of those groups simultaneously? Is very, very difficult, because
Wind and Fire, Michael Jackson.
Exactly, and you know, just demographically, they are worlds apart. And you know, are you which one of those two horses do you back? In order to guarantee the future and the success of the event going forward.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
We interrupt this podcast. Lionel, you and I have broken away from Daniel momentarily. We'll rejoin him again later on in the episode. But we're at a very cold St. Pancras station.
We are. We're going to... Well, everyone loves political discussion on the podcast, don't they? It's one of the things that keeps everyone tuning in. They love it when we express our views on Trump and Brexit and so on. Being slightly facetious here, but yeah, we're going to meet MP Damian Collins, who is the chair of the Department for Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, and they have been conducting their investigation into doping in sport lately.
And cycling has been in the spotlight this week. Nicole Cook was up before the select committee, and you know, her testimony, more about sexism than doping, got a lot of headlines. So we thought we'd, you know, we've talked about this a lot in the podcast. Some people tune out. You know, if you don't want to hear it, skip on to the next bit. But we thought it'd be interesting to speak to him as the man leading this inquiry, just to find out what the purpose of it is, what the possible outcome of the select committee hearing into doping in sport is likely to be. Obviously, Team Sky British Cycling very much in the spotlight. So let's go and meet him, shall we? Lionel, Damien Collins MP. Damien, can you just take us back to the beginning? How did this process begin? What was the catalyst for it?
The catalyst started in a different sport, which was the Sunday Times investigation looking at allegations of doping in athletics then, and the knowledge of that within the IAAF. The scandal that developed where it was alleged that IAAF officials had received payment to suppress doping results. And we started an investigation looking at doping in sport, the way in which the anti-doping rules are policed, the powers that UK Anti-Doping and the World Anti-Doping Agency have to police those, and the resources they have as well. And that led up to us calling Seb Coe to give evidence about that. And we've also had evidence from WADA, from UCAD several times, from Sir Craig Reedy. But then I think the interest then in cycling came about as the story around the famous Jiffy bag that was sent out for Bradley Wiggins developed too. Because I think we were aware, obviously, that there were historic problems, massive problems with doping in cycling. There'd been a number of reforms of the governance structures of cycling, which we thought were quite interesting comparison for athletics to follow as well, sort of separate investigatory bodies looking at doping offences. But I think when the story of the Jiffy bag emerged, I think again it posed questions for us of, well, okay, how does cycling police the anti-doping rules as well? Are there issues there that warrant further questioning and investigation? And that was our interest then in starting to gather some evidence around that. And that led to the session we had with British Cycling and with Shane Sutton and Sir Dave Brailsford to better understand some of these issues. We also took evidence from Dan Stevens, who obviously has personal experience of doping and cycling and working with UCAD trying to clean cycling up. And we've taken evidence in private from some medical experts that work with sportsmen, men and women, and understand the doping regime, but also the process of medicating riders and athletes for long-term conditions. So for us, it's been a part of a broader inquiry on doping in sport, of which the two main areas have been athletics and cycling. And I think there are some specific questions we want answers to, but there are also probably some common issues, common learnings from both those sports.
You mentioned Brailsford and Shane Sutton have been before you. What sort of powers do you have to call people to give evidence?
Well, we can require anyone within the jurisdiction of Parliament to give evidence. So that's any British national, anyone who is resident in the UK. I think it's also become an accepted modern convention that if people are asked to appear before a select committee, they do. And with British Cycling and Sir Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton, they both willingly accepted the invitation to appear and did so at as soon as sort of mutually convenient date we could find.
You've spoken to them, obviously there are other people, players in the story, Bradley Wiggins, Dr. Richard Freeman, for example, who have not appeared. Have they been called and could they be called?
I'm quite clear on what I think our role on something like this is. So I think there's a legitimate interest for Parliament to investigate doping in sport, to consider questions like should doping be a criminal matter, as it is in other countries, and to look at the way in which the public money that goes into sports is used to support and maintain those sports as well. I don't think it's the role of a select committee to investigate the medical history of an individual athlete. What I think it is our role is to call into account the bodies that run that sport. So to say to British Cycling and Team Sky, well, it's clear what the anti-doping rules are. How do you enforce them? How can you be certain that your sport is clean and being run the way you say it is? And to hold them to account for that. So that's why our starting point has been with British Cycling and with senior figures at Team Sky. Now, I've been discussing with UK Anti-Doping where we can take our inquiries further. I want to get to the bottom of it. Now, that could mean several things. That could mean that we're given documentary evidence of what was in the Jiffy bag, and that's what UCAD are trying to find out themselves. It may well be we've reached that point and UCAD can tell us, well, this is what it was, and we've got proof. We're not just taking Dr. Freeman's word for it. We know for definite. The other issue would be if they say, well, actually, we can't determine what was in the Jiffy bag. There's no documentary evidence at all to prove that it was Flumicil or anything else. then that poses a big question about, well, how can you police the anti-doping rules if you don't know what the doctor's giving the cyclists? And there's no paper trail to prove that. So these are some of the sort of questions we could get into. Now, as part of concluding that, I'm talking to UCAD about them coming back as soon as possible to give us evidence on their investigation, to report back to Parliament on what they've been able to discover so far, and also if there's evidence they've sought but not been given, what is that evidence and what is the reason it's not been provided? And so we're actually discussing that, and I think alongside that too, the committee would certainly be interested in hearing from Richard Freeman and Simon Cope about their roles. I think Dr. Freeman is the... we've heard so much about the central role that doctors play in the TUE process and in medication. So his personal perspective on what's happened, and in particular the Jiffy bag as he ordered it and administered what was in it. And Simon Cope, because I think of this interesting dual role he had working both for British Cycling and Team Sky, and I think to ask him about the questions Nicole Cook put to us this week about whether that was a good allocation of resources to use someone like him to go chasing around Europe after Team Sky delivering packages. So I think for us, those are the sort of the steps in the way. It's the public bodies and the organisations that are responsible for what goes on, and to question them about their conduct and what happened and what records there are to prove what happened. And I think that's our function in this.
Damien, I'm just interested to know whether Brian Cookson's on your list of people to call as well, because at the time of the Jiffy bag delivery, he was president of British Cycling. He was on the... if he wasn't still on the board of Tour Racing Limited, which was the parent company for Team Sky, he certainly had been at some points. And now, of course, he's president of the world governing body for cycling, the UCI. It struck me as curious that he's not been brought in to share what he knows about the whole practice of anti-doping in cycling.
I think for us, the next stage is to reach a position where, on the investigation of the Jiffy bag, where UCAD feel that they have gone as far as they can with their investigation and can tell us about that. I think the level of public interest in this matter is so great, it would be completely inadequate and wrong for there to be no answer at all, and no public presentation of what's been discovered or what's been found, for it just to be closed. That's, I think, what our next step is to get UCAD back. This would be the third time UCAD would have given evidence to us in our doping and sport inquiry to say, well, what have you found out? If you've not been able to get the evidence you want, why is that? Are people being obstructive and not giving it to you? Does the evidence exist but it's not being provided? Does it not exist at all? Do you require additional legal powers as a body to seize this evidence and information? And I think depending on what they can tell us, I think we will then know who to call next and where to go next as well. And I think clearly for us that would then involve other parties to it. I think Dr. Freeman and Simon Cope are people who've been directly involved. We've had evidence from British Cycling which gives us an idea of a much better idea of the chronology of events that led up to the delivery of the package. I think that's very interesting. We could ask Simon Cope about that. And obviously you could ask Dr. Freeman about, his role as the team doctor in ordering that medication and administering it. So I think those are sort of the next likely steps that we would follow. And depending on the evidence we receive as we go through those stages, I think we would then determine who else we might need to call.
In terms of, obviously, I'm very interested to find out definitively what was in the package, but just from the point of view of, obviously, this is a public inquiry, effectively, you're paid by the taxpayer. I mean, at the moment, no anti-doping rule has been proven to be broken. Just rolling it back a bit, what efforts are being made to try and establish whether an anti-doping rule was broken, and doesn't the whole thing kind of fall apart if no anti-doping rule was broken? Is that the way you're looking at it?
The question of whether an anti-doping rule was broken is a matter for UCAD. That's what they're investigating. So the issues for us are, in a case like this, if it's inconclusive what happened, then I think that poses questions for us about the way British Cycling keeps records. British Cycling would then have dispensed medicines that required a doctor's prescription, and they've got no record of it. There are issues then for Team Sky about how can you say that you are operating at an ethical standard that is above any other team in pro cycling, and yet you've got no records to prove what doctors are administering to your cyclists. I mean, that would pose, I think, governance issues and questions for Team Sky, and it'd be right that we should ask them. Now, again, if the investigation is inconclusive, we might say, well, actually, does UCAD need additional powers and additional resources to support it in future investigations? And indeed, should doping be a criminal offence, so that if there is reason to be suspicious that a doping violation has occurred, it's not just a matter for UCAD, but other, you know, for the police and other investigatory authorities. I mean, Nicole Cook said, you know, very clearly in our evidence to us that she's looked at doping investigations in Italy where it is a criminal offence, and people that she'd worked with were found, they were exposed because of the resources the Italian police could bring to that investigation and their legal powers to seize documents, to record conversations, and that led to wrongdoers being discovered. And she said she felt that if those people had been doing the same things in this country, they would never have been discovered because the UK authorities do not have that kind of power. So I think for us, those are the sorts of questions I think we would consider when we produce our report, which for us is the end of our investigation. We produce a report with recommendations to the government on what we think needs to be done to toughen up the anti-doping regime in sports. So from in terms of our investigation, I think it's about understanding how and why have the processes failed, if they have failed, and what lessons we have to learn from that.
I mean, would that be a possible outcome that you recommend, that perhaps doping is criminalised in this country? Is that foreseeable?
I certainly think that is exactly the sort of issue we will look at and come to a view on. And my personal view is, I think, from what I've seen in this inquiry so far, both looking at athletics and looking at cycling, I think it should be a criminal offence, as it is in other countries. I think as I said, I think it brings in other bodies to help investigate with those additional powers that they have to investigate criminal matters. It also makes people who are accessories to that doping, also they would be caught up in the criminal sanctions too. I think often it is the rider who is the person that suffers when they're caught. I mean, the person that suffers most is they're banned from competition. And people who've been accessories, they may get, you know, some minor sanction, but they're not the athlete, so it's less of an issue for them, even if they may take some reputational damage and hit from it. So I think if it was a clear criminal sanction, anyone involved in the process of supplying someone who was doping, I think that would be a big disincentive for people to engage in this. And I was very mindful of what Nicole Cook said when she was thinking about her when she was 19 and first competed in the Tour de France, that she felt not only it wasn't just that her team were giving her the option of doping, but that she was being basically actively asked to do it, and that she felt that she was then penalised for declining that request. And you'd have to wonder how many other young riders have been put in that position and felt that actually there's no one they can turn to for help, and there's not very much that can be done to investigate the people that are making these offers.
Just on Nicole Cook's evidence, the aspect of her evidence that really gained a lot of headlines was the allegations of British Cycling not really being fit as a kind of governing body, and the accusations that sexism is kind of rife in the way that British Cycling has been run, certainly in terms of allocation of resources. Given that that isn't the focus of your inquiry, what were your thoughts on reading all of that evidence, and you know, how does that fit under your umbrella, if I can put it that way?
What we're likely to do is produce two reports, or maybe one big report in two sections. One is looking at doping in sport. We've also, as a committee, been taking a considerable amount of evidence over the last 18 months looking at sports governance for UK sports governing bodies. So we've spoken to tennis, to football, to UK athletics, obviously British Cycling as well. And I think the government has also published its governance code for sport. And it's asking national governing bodies of sports to comply with that governance code, or seek, or potentially, you know, lose some of their public funding. So I think there's a separate piece of work we will do, I think, looking at the governance structures in different UK sports and saying, do we feel that they are fit for purpose, and what more needs to be done? Certainly, I think with cycling, as a result of the investigation that we've held so far, there'd be concerns for us about the close relationship between Team Sky and British Cycling, and how that is policed, how that's audited, and I think the questions that Nicole Cook raised around the resourcing of women's cycling are important too, and also the key point I think she made, that she felt that British Cycling wasn't really answerable to anyone. Now, I think actually, as a national governing body for a sport, yes, it's autonomous, it runs its own sport, but we want it to be operating at an optimum level, you know, to good governance standards. And also, I think it should be partly accountable to UK sport, certainly for the elite funding for elite sport. That's where the money comes from UK sport. And I think UK sport should take an active interest in how the money is being spent, how the public resources are being used to further the sport. And I think one of the points Nicole was pointing us, one of the directions she was pointing us in was to say, if the purpose of UK sport funding cycling is to win medals at Olympic Games, and that's a big part of it, then why is it that the women's team seem to get less support than the men's team, even at times when the women's team was more likely to win medals? And I think going back to the Jiffy bag, in particular in 2011, when Nicole Cook and Simon Cope had come up with a plan for a team training exercise for the women's road team, and that was cancelled because people had other priorities. And she felt that had the consequence of that was that the team underperformed at the World Championships when they, you know, had the ability to be winning medals.
Just finally, what's the timescale, do you think?
We're sort of in active discussions with UCAL. I spoke to Nicole Sapser today about this. I'm hoping that we can agree a date in the next few weeks when Nicole will be able to come. Nicole Sapser will be able to come to the committee and update us on UCAD's investigation. I think we'd also consider at that point if UCAD could give us guidance that we could also call other key witnesses who would be free to discuss the investigation and what they know, not restricted by UCAD's work. I think we'd certainly be interested in calling, you know, Dr. Freeman and Simon Cope. But I would see that being within the next few weeks. Certainly, I think by the end of February, I'd hope that we could have concluded our work on this and been in a position to report. But I think, given that we're investigating this, I feel I don't want to leave this hanging where we just end up in a position where there's no UCAD report and no one knows what happened. Because I think there are lots of important lessons that have to be drawn from this, and we need, I think, some closure. I think everyone in cycling, all the people who contacted me over the last few weeks, they just want to know, and I think that's what we've got to try and get to.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Okay, well, that's us for this week, chaps. We're going to be back next week with we'll cover some of the usual ground that we do in the regular podcast, but we're also going to be looking in some depth at the sponsors of teams. And this has come about because a few of you have written to us asking for our thoughts on the new Bahrain team, to give it the proper pronunciation before we have the pronunciation police on our backs. The Bahrain team, fronted, of course, by Vincenzo Nibali, quite a controversial sponsorship, given some of the allegations that have been made about the Bahrain regime and the fact that Sheikh Nasser, a member of the ruling family in Bahrain, is heavily involved with the team. We thought that rather than focus on that one team in particular, we'd actually go through all the teams and all the sponsors of all the teams, looking at who they are and where they... Well, Daniel had an idea of giving them a sort of ethical score, coming up with a marks out of 10 for ethics. You're frowning at that, Daniel, but it definitely was your idea.
Did we talk about... We didn't talk about scores, did we? It was just a general kind of report card, wasn't it? But we're going to...
Ethical report.
We should probably point out, and this is something that occurs to me, we're also going to take into account any sort of ticks by their name as far as ethics are concerned. So, for example, the Dimension Data's team's association with a Quebecer charity. So, It's not just going to be negative, is it? It's not just
Never just negative, unless, you know, it's... Sorry, Lionel, I'm not looking at you. No, we're going to... We'll run through the pros and cons of each team sponsor. Why are you shaking your head?
Get on with it.
So anyway, that's what we're doing next week. Let's also mention that we've got coming up our first Friends of the Podcast special of 2017, and that's your little baby, Lionel.
It is indeed, yeah. Went to Mallorca to spend a few days with the Lotto Soudal team, hear from several of their riders and their team manager, Mark Sargent, and get under the skin of the Belgian team, which has the longest continuous relationship with one particular sponsor, and that's the Belgian National Lottery.
Glad you clarified that after a bit of confusion last week.
You were wrong as well.
I was wrong. Movistar is actually the longest running team under different banners, different guys.
We'll maybe cover this, the etymology of the teams as well.
That's an interesting one. Yeah.
Maybe.
But it's a bit like Trigger's Broom, isn't it? On Only Fools and Horses. You remember that famous sketch?
It is.
Because how can, you can't really argue that Movistar is the same team as what? Reynolds, are you saying?
Yeah.
It kind of evolved out of and evolved out of. But you, in order to state that as a fact, you would have to dig into the parent companies and ownership and who was running them and what have you. But Echeverri's been involved, hasn't he, since the start, I think?
Yeah.
There's the sports director. So, I mean, it's loose. Joined together by a loose thread, I would say.
They've ridden bikes and they're from Spain. They've been from Spain the whole time, you know. That's about the extent of the how continuous the lineage is. But anyway, go on.
Anyway, that's all for coming up. When is that coming up, that Friends special, Lionel?
I think that will be out on Monday.
Oh, wow, that's soon.
Yeah.
Wow, we're really inundating people with podcasts. We've got Podcast Feminar this week. We've got this and then that coming up. But thank you very much indeed to everybody who's signed up as a friend of the podcast for 2017. Very grateful to you for your support, and we hope you enjoy the special podcast that you'll be getting. Roughly one a month. We'll be producing 11 this year. The first one is imminent. And you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. All that remains really this week is to say thank you very much to this week's producer, John Mooney. Thanks to 13 Senses and Glass Pear for playing our music as ever. Thank you to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.